the total going to military contractors. A large portion of these contracts, one quarter to one third of all Pentagon contracts in recent years, have gone to just five major corporations: Lockheed Martin, Boeing, General Dynamics, Raytheon, and Northrop Grumman. The report explained how China is the new justification for military spending. The most likely impact of the shift towards China will be to further tighten the grip of major weapons makers like Northrop Grumman, Lockheed Martin, General Dynamics, and Raytheon Technologies on the Pentagon budget, as the report reads.
Well, I think the U.S. Current relative decline has multiple sources. One, of course, is that after 9/11, the U.S. has very much invested in the so-called war on terror and invests so much that its domestic need has not been met. So over the years, we've seen numbers like very high numbers that the U.S. has invested in its war capabilities and is deploying military around the world, particularly in the Middle East and in Central Asia. So that's really a waste of money. However, a small group of Americans really benefited from this, and a U.S. Stock market, the capital market, also benefit from this. During this time, as you said, there are many domestic problems should be taken care of, but not being taken care of because of political divide within the United States. So, and you know, political difficulties blocking that solution. So, as we've seen over the past two decades, the infrastructure is lacking behind, and also there's a serious problem of social and economic gap between the rich and the poor. So moving forward, I think the number one priority for the U.S. should be taking care of its domestic problem instead of intervening into other countries' internal affairs.
Southeast Asia will take a major economic hit if shipping is either disrupted or, worse yet, blocked in the South China Sea. Now, that's one of the points of conflict between the U.S. and China in what is known as the South China Sea conflict, and in particular, how that serves as a trade route. Now, the U.S. wants to take the revenues produced in that region. That's somewhat of an assumption, but it seems like that is the U.S.'s goal, to take those revenues away from China or decrease it by a substantial amount. Well, to get the final comments from our guest, Jia Hai, who's a research fellow at the Institute of World Economics, and also Bill Jones, who's the Washington Bureau Chief for the Executive Intelligence Review, both rejoining us for this final segment. Jia, I'm going to start with you and our final question. The U.S. superpower status downgraded by many across the world, many analysts, be it militarily or in the economic sphere, but the U.S. is still pursuing China. On a military level, does the U.S. alienation mean that it will not have the support of countries, not only in the Asia region, but also in Europe and elsewhere, in the respect where they're not going to be on board with it to confront China?
Well, I think, first of all, the U.S. continued to be the world's most powerful country. That's for sure. Even though with current relative decline, the U.S. still maintain a superior military power comparing to all the rest of the world combined, pretty much. So I think in that respect, U.S. continued to lead in its military realm. However, the world is now diversifying, and there are multipolar other powers arising, and this world order is changing from the post-Cold War unipolar into a multipolar world. Many other countries, including Europe and China and other developing countries' groupings, are having a say in international affairs. So U.S. has no monopoly on many other issues. Many other countries can contribute in the area of like the pandemic or climate change or urgent issues that humanities are facing currently.
All right. Well, Bill, the U.S. superpower status downgraded by many, as was mentioned here, whether it's militarily or in the economic sphere. And it has fallen behind China, which is said to overtake the U.S. Economically by the year 2028 for it to be the number one economy. Is it because of the U.S. spending expenditures on wars across the globe that this has happened to the U.S.? We could mention military bases and military spending overall.
Well, yes, that latter is both are the case. The fact that they have spent a lot of money in military wars, which have led really nowhere except to further devastation, Afghanistan is a prime example of that. We can also look in the Middle East and see the same type of situation. But also there's been an utter neglect of investment in science and technology. And what the Chinese have done, with a population of 1.4 billion people, by the way, is they have followed much the example that the United States was following in the 1960s. We have to continue, you know, exerting ourselves. The almighty dollar will buy whatever we need, and therefore we don't have to do a lot of investment in science and technology, so that they became, in many respects, backwards, and the Chinese have moved forward. U.S. still remains a major scientific power, and I'm sure...
The so-called superpower status of the U.S. is in jeopardy, and the U.S. is declining in its might, both in its economy and also its military. Yes, even the military, because the U.S. can't win a conflict by air, and its ground forces, well, they couldn't even defeat the Taliban when they had 100,000 forces combined with NATO forces in that country. And now they want to take on China in the business and military arena. So desperate that the U.S. had to send its VP Harris recently to Asia to rally support around her during her recent visit of the regional countries, that is. And as far as U.S. war adventurism is concerned, Afghanistan, Iraq, Syria, Yemen, need I say more? No wins there. So obviously, remains to be seen how the U.S. is going to be able to even penetrate China's sphere economically and militarily. That does it for this edition of the program. Thanks for tuning in. From Miko Batafwe and the entire team, it's goodbye until next time.
Fiqh or jurisprudence is an Islamic knowledge and is ranked
The Holy Prophet of Islam is the example
of
self-purification is the most significant
factor.
Imamat is a living principle in the history of Islam and Shiism.
This is Ulama Speech, the best selection of the speeches of prominent Shia scholars.
In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful. Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, welcome to another episode of the program Ulama's Speech. Please accept our condolences on the martyrdom anniversary of Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam. In this episode, we invite you to listen to the English translation of a short speech by Hujjatul Islam, Mir Baqiri, about the master of the martyrs, Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam. Please stay tuned.
آثاری که در روایات برای زیارت سید الشهدا علیه السلام نقش شده ببینید ده ها و بلکه صدها اثر و ثواب هست.
We find many fruitful outcomes for paying ziyarah to the tomb of Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam in many of our narrations. Sometimes the reward for visiting the tomb of Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam is considered as equal to jihad and getting martyred in the way of Allah. Some other times it is regarded as infaq, or freeing a slave for the sake of Allah. Yet in other cases, the reward for visiting the tomb of Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam is equal to Hajj pilgrimage, and even the steps that are taken on this way are considered holy and full of rewards.
در روایات است که باز نسبت به طهارت نفس فرمود کسی که کربلا می رود و زیارت می کنه.
In other series of narrations, we see that when a person is leaving the city of Karbala, when he has finished visiting the tomb of Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam, an angel will come down to him from the Holy Prophet of Islam and will promise him to clean away all his sins and accept his repentance if he had sincere repentance in the holy shrine of Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam. As we can see, this is a big step for a Muslim to get to a place that his repentance is accepted by Allah, and this task, according to the authentic narrations, is possible through visiting the tomb of Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam in Karbala. Thank you very much, dear listeners of iRab English Radio, for listening to this episode of Ulama's Speech, which was the English translation of a short speech by Hujjatul Islam Mir Baghiri. To find out more about this program, please log on to our website, parstoday.com/en, Call of Islam page. We leave you in Allah's care, and goodbye.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight. France's historic decision to recall its ambassadors to the United States and Australia is far more than a diplomatic spat, analysts have warned. The move in protest at Canberra's surprise decision to cancel an order for French-built submarines and its security pact with Washington and London will affect France and Europe's role in NATO, and already strained relations with the United Kingdom. The article you're about to hear has been written by the Guardian columnist Kim Wilshire. The piece is titled AUKUS, France's ambassador recall is tip of the iceberg, says analysts. France's historic decision to recall its ambassadors to the United States and Australia is far more than a diplomatic spat, analysts have warned. The move in protest at Canberra's surprise decision to cancel an order for French-built submarines and its security pact with Washington and London will affect France and Europe's role in NATO and already strained relations with the United Kingdom. French officials have accused Australia, the United States, and the United Kingdom of behaving in an underhand, duplicitous manner that has betrayed and humiliated France. A visibly angry Jean-Yves Le Drian, the French foreign minister, accused the Americans and Australians of lies and duplicity over the AUKUS deal. And he warned, it's not finished. Jean-Yves Le Drian said Australia had told France that it was breaking the submarine contract and making a new deal with the United States and the United Kingdom just 1 hour before Scott Morrison, the Australian Prime Minister, announced it at a press conference. That is why I say there has been duplicity, contempt and lies. And when you have an ally of the stature of France, you don't treat them like that, Le Drian said. Asked if there had been a failure of French intelligence in uncovering the secret deal, he replied, the agreement project initiated by the United States and Australia was decided by a small group, and I'm not sure US and Australian ministers knew about it. When we see the US president with the Australian Prime Minister announce a new agreement with Boris Johnson, the breach of trust is profound. In a real alliance, you talk to each other. You don't hide things, you respect the other party, and that is why this is a real crisis. French Foreign Minister Jean-Yves Le Drian rejected suggestions that France was isolated within the European Union in its response to the AUKUS deal. The Foreign Minister said, I don't believe we're alone in this affair. It's not finished. Asked why France had not recalled its ambassador to the United Kingdom, Le Drian went on to say Britain's role was opportunistic and described the country as the fifth wheel of the wagon. The UK accompanied this operation opportunistically, a French diplomat source told the Reuters news agency. We do not need to consult in Paris with our ambassador to know what to think and what conclusions to draw from it. This is far more than just a diplomatic spat. The withdrawal of ambassadors is the tip of the iceberg, Peter Ricketts, a former permanent undersecretary at the Foreign Office and former British ambassador to France, told the BBC. There is a deep sense of betrayal in France because this wasn't just an arms contract. This was France setting up a strategic partnership with Australia, and the Australians have now thrown that away and negotiated behind the backs of France with two NATO allies, the US and Britain, to replace it with a completely different contract. For the French, this looks like a complete failure of trust between allies and calls into doubt what is NATO for. This puts a big rift down the middle of the NATO alliance. Britain needs a functioning NATO alliance. Peter Ricketts added, I think people underestimated the impact that this would have in France and how this would seem as a humiliation and a betrayal in a year that President Macron is running for re-election in a very tight race with the far right. The historic order to recall France's ambassadors came directly from President Macron. A spokesperson for the Élysée Palace said the seriousness of the situation required the president's response. beyond the question of the breach of a contract and its consequences, particularly in terms of jobs, there is what this decision says about the alliance strategy. Such behavior is unacceptable between allies, the Elisa Palace said. The French are furious at Australia's decision to cancel a $90 billion Australian dollar contract, £48 billion contract, that it signed with the French company Naval Group in 2016 for a fleet of 12 state-of-the-art attack-class submarines. That deal became bogged down in cost overruns, delays, and design changes. Naval Group said the new deal that will see Canberra acquire nuclear-powered submarines built by the United States and Britain instead of those from France was a great disappointment. Jean-Yves Le Drian had already described the trilateral AUKUS security pact, including the submarine deal, as a stab in the back for France. The abandoning of the Ocean-class submarine project that linked Australia and France since 2016 and the announcement of a new partnership with the United States to launch studies on possible future cooperation on nuclear-powered submarines constitute unacceptable behavior between allies and partners, the consequences of which affect the very conception we have of our alliances, our partnerships, and the importance of the Indo-Pacific region for Europe, he added. France is also furious at what it sees as the dishonesty of statements coming out of Australia, whose Prime Minister Scott Morrison said Canberra wanted nuclear submarines with more autonomy and more discreet than the conventional submarines that France proposed. France says it altered the design of its nuclear submarines to diesel because that is what Australia wanted and ordered. In terms of the Indo-Pacific partnership, France is a natural ally for Australia as it has overseas territories, home to more than 1.6 million French citizens in the region. Paris also has a significant military presence in that region, with 8,000 soldiers and dozens of ships, including nuclear submarines, positioned in several bases. Nathalie Goulet, an opposition member and vice president of the French Senate's Foreign Affairs, Defense and Armed Forces Commission, said the situation was very disturbing. Someone should have warned before this breach of contract. I don't understand this could have happened overnight, she said. It's a failure for industry, intelligence and communication, and a public humiliation. And nobody likes to be humiliated, even the French. It is the first time France has recalled a US ambassador. The two countries have been allies since the U.S. War of Independence. France also cancelled a gala due to be held on Friday, 17th of September, to commemorate the anniversary of the Battle of Chesapeake Bay, a decisive event in the war which ended with the French fleet's victory over the British on 5th of September, 1781. A White House official told the Reuters news agency that the U.S. regretted the French decision and said Washington had been in close touch with Paris. The official said the U.S. would be engaged in the coming days to resolve differences between the two countries. The Australian Foreign Minister, Maryse Payne, in Washington said she understood the disappointment in Paris and hoped to work with France to ensure it understands the value we place on the bilateral relationship and the work that we want to continue to do together.
Wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes. Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
The Shanghai Cooperation Organization, SCO, has approved documents for Iran's full membership at the Eurasian Political, Economic, and Security Alliance. The decision came as the 21st summit of the organization opened in Dushanbe earlier in the day. The Islamic Republic joined the SCO in 2005 as an observer state.
SCO, with the current membership, covers close to 50% of the world population and about one-third of the world's GDP. Being a member of this organization will take a lot of pressure away in terms of Western sanctions, Western impositions, monetary manipulations via the US dollar as a remedy for payment. No more.
Leaders from eight member states and four observer states attended the annual summit in Tajikistan's capital on Friday, with the Chinese leader Xi Jinping addressing it virtually along with Russian president. Xi criticized sanctions imposed on world economic exchanges, urging the SCO members to stay united against attacks by other countries. Iran's President Ebrahim Raisi and his counterparts from Tajikistan, Kyrgyzstan, Kazakhstan, Belarus, Pakistan, Turkmenistan, and Uzbekistan attended in person. Addressing the summit, President Raisi said the world today has entered a new era when hegemony and unilateralism are declining.
The world is entering a new era with a new order. Domination and unilateralism are on the decline. International order is moving toward multipolarization and redistribution of power in favor of independent states.
The Iranian president also underlined that sanctions are preventing regional cooperation and urged the SCO to define mechanisms to fight these challenges. In his address at the SCO summit, Iran's President Ebrahim Raisi described sanctions as economic terrorism and the hegemonic power's most important tool to impose their own will on the others. He warned that unilateral sanctions are not limited to one country, but as it has become clear in recent years, they include more independent countries, particularly the SCO member states. Two key members of the alliance, Russia and China, have also come under sanctions from the West. Ties between Washington and Beijing deteriorated after former U.S. President Donald Trump took office in 2017, waging an economic war against China. While many expected the current administration of Joe Biden to mark a departure from Trump's hawkish policies, it adopted a tougher stance against China and Russia, imposing several rounds of sanctions on them on various pretexts.
Western trade currency restrictions do not exist in the SCO member countries. This will drastically reduce the potential for Western sanctions and will increase, on the other hand, Iran's potential to deal with the East, for example, or especially China and Russia, entering partnership agreements with these and other SCO countries, benefiting from comparative advantages.
At the end of the summit, SCO member states signed the Dushanbe Declaration, in which they stress opposition to interference under the excuse of counterterrorism or human rights, or solving key international and regional issues through small cliques, ideology, or confrontation mentality. They also agreed on strengthening cooperation in cracking down on terrorism, extremism, and separatism, and reached a consensus in supporting building an inclusive government in Afghanistan.
The Israeli regime has reportedly started a cyber sabotage campaign in the UAE to interfere with the regional air and maritime navigation in West Asia.
Cyber warfare is becoming more and more important and more dangerous as well. So Israel wants to take advantage of any opportunities there.
The campaign seeks to disrupt the Persian Gulf and the Sea of Oman region's air and maritime navigation systems, thus destabilizing the regional security situation. On the other hand, the bid seeks to transit the focal point of crisis away from the occupied territories towards the region and therefore reduce the political and security pressure faced by the regime's ruling body. The UAE has signed dozens of memorandums of understanding with Israel since it became the first Arab state to normalize ties with Israel this century.
Israel sees itself with the Sunni monarchies and the conservatives as their potential allies in this. So it wants to be able to conduct the kind of cyber sabotage and infiltration that is becoming so important, so much more important. So it's not surprising that they would do this when they have the opportunity, and the UAE is providing that opportunity for them.
Israel has said that it expects $1 billion in trade with the UAE by the end of 2021, and $3 billion in 3 years. The UAE aims to raise the value of economic activity with Israel to more than $1 trillion in the next 10 years. According to regional observers, at the heart of the UAE's desire to normalize ties with the regime in Tel Aviv was its penchant for U.S.-made F-35 fighter jets, which the peace deals with Israel, known as the Abraham Accords, made possible. To the Persian Gulf state, established full diplomatic relations with the Tel Aviv regime in a deal brokered by the former U.S. President Donald Trump. Shortly after the deal was reached, the Trump administration authorized the sale of 50 advanced F-35 fighter jets to the UAE. The UAE and Israel are reportedly deepening their ties and espionage activities in the region. The UAE has helped Israel set up a center for military and maritime reconnaissance on the strategic Yemeni island of Socotra. The Red Crescent Society of the United Arab Emirates has signed a contract with the Tel Aviv regime in order to create an intelligence center for the Israeli Air Force at Socotra Airport. Socotra is home to some 60,000 people. It overlooks the Bab el-Mandab Strait, a main shipping route that connects the Red Sea to the Gulf of Aden and the Arabian Sea. It also has a unique ecosystem, which is already being exploited by the Emiratis. The mission reportedly aimed at collecting information from across the Gulf of Aden, including Bab el-Mandab and south of Yemen, which is under the control of forces backed by the UAE. Socotra has been a source of tensions between the UAE and Saudi Arabia. They have been jockeying for position for control of the island's unique resources in the absence of a powerful government in Yemen amid a ferocious war on the country. Back in June 2020, UAE-backed separatists of the so-called Southern Transitional Council, or the STC, took control of Socotra.
As you know, Israel has always welcomed the opportunity to have alliances within what it has considered to be the enemy camp, namely the Arabs. And in the opportunity with an alliance is to profit in various ways, to build one's power through espionage.
A new security pact involving the United States, Britain, and Australia has triggered controversy and condemnation. The U.S. and U.K. announced this week that they will provide Australia with advanced technology to build nuclear-powered submarines. Based on their agreement, Australian naval forces will have atomic submarines that are much faster as they use nuclear propulsion systems and harder to detect than conventional fleets. They can spend months under the sea and target longer distances with their missiles. The leaders of the three countries hailed the New Deal as a step that will make it easier to counter threats in the Indo-Pacific. They repeatedly mentioned regional security concerns, which they said had grown significantly. None of them mentioned China, but the pact is being widely viewed as an initiative to counter Chinese influence in the region, including in the contested resource-rich South China Sea.
Well, there are two elements here. One is the fact that this alliance could be a new version of NATO for Indo-Pacific region, and the other is that this purchase of nuclear-powered submarine could be an initial step to transfer more technology to nuclear technology to Australia, maybe in the long term having Australia acquiring nuclear bomb capacity.
The United States and its allies make no secret of their intensified efforts to try to contain the growing Chinese influence and power there. Many observers believe the newly announced deal is in line with those efforts. Meanwhile, the development is expected to further sour relations between Beijing and Canberra. In recent years, political tensions have grown between the two over a number of issues, including Australia's stance against Chinese telecom giant Huawei. Chinese Foreign Ministry spokesman Xiao Lijian criticized what he called the U.S.-led alliance's obsolete Cold War mentality and warned the three countries against moves that would hurt their own interests. Some Chinese media went so far as to say that Australia had now turned itself into an adversary of China. What are the implications of this new pact and other moves against China for regional and international security? Meanwhile, China was not the only party infuriated by the new security pact. France condemned it too. That is because Australia will now scrap a deal with France to buy a dozen conventional submarines worth tens of billions of dollars. France's Foreign Minister Jean-Yves Le Drian called Australia's agreement with the US and the UK a stab in the back. France said the development underscored the need to bolster a, quote, European strategic autonomy. The United States and arch-rival China may have toned down their rhetoric against each other, but tensions between the two superpowers are simmering as they remain deeply engaged in an intense global rivalry. There are many flashpoints in their testy relationship, including tensions in the South China Sea and the issue of Taiwan. America has made it clear that its military will maintain a strong presence in the Indo-Pacific, where the U.S. has been trying to contain the growing influence of its arch-rival. America seems determined to follow policies aimed at containing the Chinese influence worldwide. And with China absolutely unwilling to back down, tensions are expected to mount in the coming years.
The political climate created by the global war on terror after the 9/11 attacks set the stage for large increases in the Pentagon budget, much of which went to military contractors. A new article by Brown University's Cost of War Project has shed light on military spending by the Pentagon after 9/11. The Pentagon budget increased by over 10% in the first year after the 9/11 attacks and the commencement of the war in Afghanistan. The Pentagon budget untimely increased year after year for 10 years running and peaked in 2010 at the highest level since World War II.
President Eisenhower, when he was leaving office, talked about the military-industrial complex, and these are the people that supply the weapons for wars. And in order to have a war, you have to have some type of threat, and that was provided by 9/11, and they decided to cash in on that. This provided unique opportunities for stealing money.
The study says over $14 trillion was spent by the Pentagon since the start of the war in Afghanistan. The report says $4.4 trillion of the total spending went towards weapons procurement and research and development. That category directly benefited corporate military contractors. Out of the $4.4 trillion, the top five U.S. weapons makers, Lockheed Martin, Boeing, General Dynamics, Raytheon, and Northrop Grumman, received $2.2 trillion, almost half. Besides getting paid for weapons and research, U.S. corporations profit from private contractors that are deployed to war zones. The most notorious private security contractor previously employed by the Pentagon is Blackwater, It is a mercenary group whose employees massacred 17 people in Iraq's Nasser Square back in 2007. The Pentagon also employed private contractors for just about every task in U.S. war zones. At the end of the Trump administration, only 2,500 U.S. troops were left in Afghanistan, but over 18,000 Pentagon contractors were still in the country.
And what we saw recently was that a lot of those weapons that got left behind were delivered within weeks of the end of the war. I mean, very close to pulling out, which meant that they had to unload them in order to cash in on what they were doing. They also unloaded them into a group of people who could use them to destabilize the region, which was also their intent.
The report explained how China is the new justification for military spending. As the U.S. has reduced the size of its military footprint in Iraq and Afghanistan, exaggerated estimates of the military challenges allegedly posed by China have become the new rationale of choice in arguments for keeping the Pentagon budget at historically high levels. The most likely impact of the shift towards China will be to further tighten the grip of major weapons makers like Northrop Grumman, Lockheed Martin, General Dynamics, and Raytheon Technologies on the Pentagon budget. Over the past few years, the U.S. has adopted a confrontational approach toward China. There are many contentious issues the two countries have been quarreling over.
China is much more complicated because both countries, China and the United States, are tied together economically in a way that would be very difficult to disentangle over, in short notice. The United States is dependent on China for a large bulk of its manufacturers, including crucial manufacturers like computer chips.
The U.S. accuses China of genocide against the Uyghur population in the province of Xinjiang. China has rejected the accusations, asking the U.S. to stop interfering in what Beijing considers its internal affairs. The two countries have also been locked in a trade dispute since 2018, when the Trump administration imposed tariffs on more than $360 billion US of Chinese goods, and China retaliated with tariffs on more than $110 billion of US products. U.S. meddling in the South China Sea and provocative speeches by U.S. officials have also angered China, with Beijing accusing Washington of being the direct driver of tensions in the region.
In the limelight.
Abdul Malik, who had never so much as belonged to a political party or group, was looted of what he had saved for his family, tortured and shot to death by soldiers wearing the uniform of and receiving their salary from Abu Dhabi, says Ahmad Abdul Karim, journalist, in an article titled, Grief and Anger After UAE Soldiers Torture and Kill Yemeni American Student Trying to Visit Family. Stay tuned for more. As his hope that the Sana'a International Airport will be reopened has faded, smiley face Abdul Malik Anwar Al-Sanabani, a 25-year-old Yemeni-American living in Fresno, California, finally decided to take the risky journey across the south of Yemen in order to see his family in Sana'a. Al-Sanabani had gone 8 years away from his loved ones. Recently, he arrived at southern Yemen's Aden Airport, where he shared his last Facebook post before his smiley face became bloodied and bruised. Abdul Malik, a graduate of Huntsville Community College, was not kidnapped, imprisoned, and tortured like the thousands of Yemeni students traveling through Saudi-controlled points of entry have been. Rather, he was robbed, tortured, and murdered at a checkpoint in the Tor al-Baha district in northern Lahej province by the security belt forces of Transitional Council, an armed militant group backed by the United Arab Emirates. Abdulmalik's father recounted to Mint Press that we were in constant contact with Abdulmalik during his trip before communication was cut on Wednesday afternoon. Later, his family was surprised when media outlets and statesmen by officials affiliated with the Saudi-led coalition in Tor al-Baha began reporting the arrest of their son possessing sums of money. His father said, "We quickly traveled to Aden but were shocked to find his dead body in the morgue of the Republican Hospital in Aden after he had been tortured and killed." Abdulmalik's body was full of bruises and wounds, indicating that he had been tortured. There were also three bullet entry wounds in his back and a fourth in his leg, according to Al-Sanbani family. Abdulmalik, who had never so much as belonged to a political party or group, was looted of what he had saved for his family, tortured and killed by gunshots by soldiers wearing the uniform of and receiving their salary from Abu Dhabi. He committed no crime, but Abdulmalik was not the only one to meet such a fate because of the region from which he hailed, his sect or his family. Recently, four students, Hussam Tariq al-Shaybani, Ibrahim Ahmad al-Shahari, Ahmad Moin al-Madani and Yahya Mansour al-Araghi, were kidnapped when they arrived at Aden Airport. Their families told Mint Press News that their fate is still unknown, a fact confirmed by the General Union of Yemeni Students in Malaysia, which issued a statement in the wake of the disappearance. Since 2015, when the Saudi war, supported by the United States and other Western military powers, transformed this nation on the Arabian Peninsula into a large prison for millions of Yemenis, students studying abroad along with stranded medical patients and expatriates have had only this option to return home, either across Al-Mahra, Sion in the east, or Aden in the south, all routes that pass through Lahej, Shabwa and Ma'arib, areas under Saudi-led coalition control. As soon as they arrive at these places, militants affiliated with Saudi Arabia or the UAE check their identities. If they live in provinces, cities, streets, or even neighborhoods that are classified as a hotbed for Ansarullah, or if they belong to certain Yemeni families or are affiliated with a Shia Muslim sect, they are often arrested, tortured, and imprisoned. The plights of Abdulmalik and four other students have touched the hearts of Yemenis across the political and religious divide and sparked an uproar inside the country and abroad. In the United States, hundreds of Yemeni expatriates took to the streets in Michigan, California, and New York. Protesters condemned the crime and held the UAE responsible, calling for the Sana'a International Airport to be reopened so that Yemenis can travel safely without the risk of imprisonment, torture, and death. In Yemen, dozens of protests were held, mostly in northern provinces, but the largest demonstration was in Abdulmalik's hometown of Dhamar, a city in southwestern Yemen. There, many of his relatives who spoke to Mint Press News accused both the Biden administration and the UAE of murdering a family member and U.S. citizen. If the Sana'a airport was open, Abdulmalik would now live in peace. We know, in fact, that the airport siege is supported by America. Hani al-Sanabani, one of Abdulmalik's relatives, told Minpress News in the wake of a protest that took place in Sanaban. Abdulmalik's death has also triggered condemnation from nearly all Yemeni political parties, human rights organizations, activists, journalists, lawyers, and members of the Yemeni community in the United States. The closure of the Sana'a airport and the imposition of an air embargo have exacerbated the humanitarian situation for many civilians, both inside and outside the country. With the continued absence of safe corridors, many stranded students, patients, and professionals recently deported from Saudi Arabia are left in a state of legal limbo, unable to secure citizenship in neighboring countries and therefore unable to work, leaving them with no way to earn money short of begging on the street or agreeing to sell their organs. In 2018, Musa al-Izaki, the editor of Yemen's widely circulated Al-Hayat newspaper, made a very public offer to sell one of his kidneys to the highest bidder. Al-Izaki coordinated with his brother, who was living in Egypt at the time, to place an ad in a Cairo newspaper with the caption, "Under compelling circumstances, I regret to announce the sale of my kidney to pay rent. If someone wants to buy a kidney, please call me." It's unknown if Al-Izaki ever found a buyer. Since 2015, the Saudi bombing of civilians and infrastructure and the imprisonment and torture of political opponents have often characterized the news from Yemen. But the imprisonment of students in secret prisons supervised and managed by both the United Arab Emirates and Saudi Arabia, a fact that is well known and likely supported by the United States regime, may be the darkest chapter in this dirty war. The death of Abdulmalik and other students have again sparked concerns among millions of Yemenis, particularly expatriates, students, and medical patients stranded abroad, about the unchecked violence carried out by the Saudi-led coalition in their country. The incidents further highlighted the dangers faced by Yemenis seeking to travel across the country in dangerous circumstances, and the role of the United States in the ongoing suffering of Yemenis who struggle against starvation, epidemics, and bombing. It is estimated that nearly 4 million Yemenis are currently stranded abroad, according to data provided by the Sana'a International Airport Media Center. This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily round the clock for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via internet, shortwave, medium wave, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 41 meters, 7,410 kilohertz, every day from 15:20 to 16:20 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave, 31 meters, 9,835 kHz every day from 19:20 to 20:20 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our program via FM 91.5 MHz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat-3B, and IranSat, or BAT-5, and via internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program P.O. Box 19395-6767 Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
انسان را مطمئن می کند ذکر خدا ذکر الله تطمئن القلوب.
Be aware, the hearts find rest in Allah's remembrance.
Spring of truth.
Allahu ya Allah subhanallah. Allahu ya Allah walhamdulillah. Allahu wa la ilaha illa
Dear brothers and sisters, you're listening to The Spring of Truth from IRIB English Radio. In this special episode, we select a short part of Imam Khomeini's will. We take pride that the fifth Imam, Baqir al-Ulum, peace be upon him, is the greatest personality of history, and no one but the Almighty Allah, his messenger, and the infallible Imams has appreciated his status. We take pride that we belong to Jafar School of Jurisprudence and Fiqh, and ours, a vast and endless ocean, has been developed by him. We are proud of infallible Imams, and we pray our allegiance to them. We take pride that the infallible Imams were imprisoned, lived in exile, and finally became martyrs while enhancing Islam, implanting the Holy Quran, the establishment of just and righteous rule being one of its dimensions, and while toppling the tyrannical governments and the oppressors of their time.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitan rajim. Bismillahir rahmanir rahim. Dear listeners, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. And you are listening to Spring of Truth coming to you from IRIB English Radio. So stay tuned with us. I am your host, Abdullah Al-Musawi, an Islamic researcher at the Seminary of Qom. We are looking at Imam Khomeini's point of view when it comes to Ashura. Imam Al-Khomeini was quoted saying, "Don't think that we weep and arrange these morning meetings to please the master of martyrs. No. He has no need for our tears, and our tears per se cannot do anything. But these lamentations and gatherings and meetings unite the people and give them direction." Throughout history, the Ahlul Bayt, the Imams, the Holy Infallible Imams, they emphasized and instructed their followers to hold morning gatherings for Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam. For many reasons, of course, and reasons maybe we will never know.
When your horse returns to our camp riderless, and your son and I emerge how sorrowful, why did you leave us to fend for ourselves? Hussein, Hussein, the slain
martyr. What's apparent is that throughout these gatherings, we are united. So the Imam Khomeini says, united, and he uses the word direction. That when you see masses throughout Ashura, the days of Ashura, the first 10 days of Muharram, or through the 40th of Imam al-Hussein, Arba'een, when you see millions of people getting together, rallying for one purpose, going for one direction, which is Imam al-Hussein, salamullah alayhi, then there is a message to every tyrant. That's a message to every oppressor. That's a message to show that we have an aim, that we have a goal,